So my presentation will be about the treatment of venous thromboembolism. I will review some recent recommendations. So first, in terms of disclosure, I don't have any financial conflicts of interest. However, I do have some intellectual conflict of interest. I was actually the co-chair of the guidelines I'm going to discuss. And I'm currently a methodologist for the American Society for Hematology guidelines on the same topic. So in terms of outline, I will start by reviewing the guideline development process very briefly. I'm going to review some selected recommendations, two or three of them. And at the end, I'm going to discuss the applicability of some of those recommendations to our context. So what are clinical practice guidelines? So these are statements that include recommendations intended to optimize patient care that are informed by a systematic review of evidence and assessment of the benefits and harms of alternative care options. The key thing in that definition is that now a guideline is not accepted as a good quality guideline without a rigorous process that includes a systematic review of the evidence. So this is the guideline I'm talking about. It was published about 1 year ago. And this is just one example of the recommendation, just to show you how these recommendations look like. You might have seen this. So that's a statement that says, in most patients with acute pulmonary embolism not associated with hypotension, we, the panel, recommend against systematically administered thrombolytic therapy. So this was one of the recommendations. And as you see, to each recommendation, there will be an associated grade. So grade 1B in this case, 1 refers to the strength of recommendation. I explain this very shortly. And B refers to the quality of the evidence supporting that recommendation. So this is, I will not go into the detail. This is just to show you the complexity of the process of developing clinical practice guidelines. It involves several groups here on the left side. The panel, which is the group of experts. It involves groups that conduct systematic reviews. It involves the organizing committee. And it goes through a long process from on top, you see priority setting, which questions is this guideline going to address, formulating the questions, which is a challenging exercise, and then going through the process of systematically reviewing the evidence, and then bringing that evidence in a processed format to the panel and going through the remaining of the process, which includes, at the end, updating of the guidelines. So this process takes usually 2 to 3 years. So you could imagine that sometimes by the time a guideline is published, the evidence is already outdated by at least 1 year. So this is always one of the challenges. One of the other challenges is the conflict of interest issue, where now it's a major issue in guidelines, and every guideline organization has to have a conflict of interest policy. The other thing is cost and resources. It's a very resource-intensive process. Any idea about how much it costs to develop a guideline? Yeah, so it's so in the UK, the NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, reports spending about 600,000 UK pounds, so almost $1 million for each guideline. The World Health Organization reports spending about $300,000 for each guideline, so it's a very intensive process, in addition to all the other resources that are needed. So the CHEST guideline in 2012 version included 400 recommendations. In 2016, they decided to go down to 30 recommendations for the different reasons I mentioned. So, and I'm going to present some of these of the 2016 recommendations. So it included a voting process to select topics. And as you will see, each recommendation, as I mentioned, has this quality of supporting evidence, high, moderate, and low, indicated by one of these letters, and then a strength of the recommendation. So a recommendation could be either strong or conditional. So what does that mean? If you have a strong recommendation, it means that for most of your patients, they should receive the recommended course of action. So think about giving a course of steroids, systemic steroids, and COPD exacerbation. A conditional recommendation is a recommendation where you will not apply it to every patient. You will have sometimes to involve the patient. in that decision-making process, because there might be some pros and cons, there might be some costs involved, and the evidence might not be that strong. So, you know, you kind of say to the patient, you could go for it, there's some benefit, but there are also harms, there's some cost, and you go through the shared decision-making process. So when the New York Times picked up on those guidelines, and obviously they had a more interesting title, Fighting the Incredible Shrinking Airline Seat. I'm sure you've been in that situation. What they did, if you look at the last two lines, they actually highlighted the issue of the grade of recommendation, and they say this acknowledges that the evidence is of low quality. So this grade will come back with every recommendation. So let me go through a few of those recommendations. So the first one is about the use of compression stocking to prevent post-thrombotic syndrome. So a substantive number of patients who suffer deep vein thrombosis end up with having this chronic debilitating disease. And one of the interventions that have been recommended is compression stockings. And in the 2012 guidelines, so this is the previous edition, this was the recommendation. In patients with acute symptomatic DVT of the leg, we suggest the use of compression stocking. So it was a recommendation in favor. The two indicates that it was a conditional recommendation, mainly because the evidence was not that high. There were a couple of low-quality trials suggesting that if you use the compression stocking, you will have improvement in the symptom. And then there's the remark that the compression stocking should be worn for 2 years, and we suggest beyond that if patients have developed PTS and find the stocking helpful. And now, so in between the 2012 and 2016 guidelines comes out the SOX trial. And in brief, the SOX trial finds that when you look at PTS versus no PTS, when you look at compression stocking versus no compression stocking, the effect on post-thrombotic syndrome, the hazard ratio is 1.13 and the p-value is 0.58. And this trial was much larger than the other ones and used placebo. So they actually had elastic stockings that had no pressure as a placebo to prevent any subjective impact on the assessment of the outcome. So as you can imagine, now the recommendation is against. However, it's still a conditional recommendation against. It's not a strong recommendation against. So in patients with acute DVT of the leg, we suggest not using compression stocking routinely to prevent post-thrombotic syndrome. So it's a two, meaning condition. It means that you as a clinician could still, so a patient who says, okay, I know that it might not work, but you know, I in no way I want to get this my leg this ugly or having chronic symptoms. And I'm willing to try it irrespective. I'm willing to put on the stocking. So in this case, this condition recommendation means that you could still do that. And in fact, the remark talks about the use of compression stocking more in the acute phase. So it says this recommendation focuses on prevention of the chronic complication of post-thrombotic syndrome and not on the treatment of symptoms. For patients with acute or chronic symptoms, a trial of graduated compression stocking is often justified. So in the acute setting, a patient who's admitted with really bad inflamed DVT, these could still be used for the management of symptoms. Okay, the next recommendation is about subsegmental PE. So subsegmental PE was not included in the previous version of the guideline. However, as part of the prioritization process, the ACCP membership, there was a process of asking for, you know, what are the questions of interest, came up with this question. And the reason is, this is more relevant is because the incidence of subsegmental PE went from 5% to more than 10%. And this is because CTs have improved in quality, so they are able to detect smaller defects. But also we are using the CAT scanning much more frequently. However, the cost of this is a false positive rate. We know that many of these, they look like subsegmental PE, are just defects that are not real PE, but they are there. So you do the scan and you have subsegmental PE. On one hand, you don't want to miss PE that could get complicated and lead to bad outcomes. On the other hand, if it's a false positive, you are giving anticoagulants to a patient and risking the unnecessary bleeding, which could be fatal. So that was one of the challenging recommendations. And here's the recommendation. So in patients with subsegmental PE, as long as there is no involvement of more proximal pulmonary arteries and there is no proximal DVT, because if you already have proximal DVT, it's done, you have to treat. And if the patient has low risk for recurrent VTE, and there's some text to help with that, we suggest clinical surveillance over anticoagulation. And in the second type of population where you have high risk of recurrent VTE, the recommendation, which is again a conditional recommendation, it's a suggestion, it's a two instead of one, is in favor of anticoagulation. And the remark which sometimes brings more granularity to the recommendation states that ultrasound imaging of the deep veins of both legs should be done to exclude proximal DVT. Clinical surveillance can be supplemented by serial ultrasound imaging of the proximal deep veins of both legs to detect evolving DVT. Patients and physicians are more likely to opt for clinical surveillance if there is good cardiopulmonary reserve or a high risk of bleeding. So it kind of gives you some direction. It's still a challenging recommendation because at the end of the day, you are stuck with a patient with that case and you have to decide whether to go either way. The recommendation is just saying you could go either way. It's trying to give you some guidance and some tips on what you could consider. And as is stated in all guidelines, it's always good to involve the patients in these conditional recommendations because the patient might say, you know what, in no way I'm taking anticoagulants. So, you know, during the discussion, so the U.S. and Europe, so if a patient is a Jehovah's Witness who, you know, if they bleed, they cannot get transfused based on their beliefs, in this case, they might say, that kind of patient might say, in no way I'm going to take the anticoagulants. Versus another patient who's had a bad history of DVT might go for it. Okay, so diagnosis of subsegmental PE is more likely to be correct. So again, some more guidance in the document. If the angiogram, the CT scan, is of high quality with good opacification of distal pulmonary arteries. So the opacification gets to the distal arteries and there's a defect in the middle, so that's more suggestive. The defects are multiple, involve more proximal subsegmental arteries, are seen on more than one image, surrounded by contrast. Patients are symptomatic, as opposed to someone who's totally asymptomatic. High clinical pretest probability, and the D-dimer is high. Again, difficult situations to deal with, but some tips on how to go about it. It just reflects the uncertainty that the guideline panel, even the experts, have to deal with. They will not give you a clear answer in this case because of the status of the evidence. So I move now to another recommendation that was one of the more expected recommendations. Everyone was waiting for what is the new recommendation when it comes to long-term management of VTE? So meaning, do you give the Coumadin / warfarin syndrome, our classic medication, versus the newer anticoagulants. So which are the, that could be called NOAC, SOAC, or DOAC. So you will see these terms being used interchangeably. The International Society for Thrombosis and Hemostasis recommends to use DOAC, so you'll probably be seeing this term more frequently. But actually, they refer to the same class of medication. As I said, this was an anticipated recommendation. So as part of the process, there's a systematic review team that looks at all the available evidence, summarizes it, and presents it in a table to the guideline panel. So now I will show you what the guideline panel was presented with and had to make a recommendation based on. So this is the table. So this is for rivaroxaban versus Syntrom, or, you know, oral anticoagulants, so which is similar to Coumadin or warfarin. So I'll show you on this side. Sorry for this, but you will see that on mortality, so this is organized by outcome. So effect on mortality, there is moderate quality evidence, but if you look at the effect estimate, it's very close to one, and it's not significant. And when you look at the absolute effect, it's one fewer per thousand. That's the best effect estimate. Which means if you have 1,000 patients on Syntrom, and instead of giving them Syntrom, you decide to switch them to rivaroxaban in this case, out of those 1,000, only one will benefit in terms of mortality. But again, this is still imprecise. This is moderate quality evidence. Recurrent VTE, that's the second outcome, still not statistically significant. It's moderate quality evidence, and it's two fewer per 1,000. The only outcome that was different between the two classes of medication is major bleeding. If you look at major bleeding, the relative risk is 0.55, which is considered substantive reduction in terms of, in relative terms, statistically significant. And if you focus on the last column at the in the corner, it says 8 fewer per 1,000. So again, to make this clear, if you have 1,000 patients on Syntrom, and instead of giving them Syntrom, you give them the DOAC, out of the 1,000, 8 will benefit in terms of preventing a major bleed they would have had with Syntrom. So this is the extent of the benefit. So let me ask you to be the panel who's voting on this. Would you, so, and I'll ask you, who would vote in terms of Syntrom as a recommendation and who would vote in favor of rivaroxaban? So who would vote in favor of Syntrom? Okay, we have one, two. Okay, what about rivaroxaban? Okay, we don't have many, but we have a bit more. Can anyone who voted for rivaroxaban just tell us why? What's the reason? Yes, please.
They have less bleeding and no need for the treatment.
Yes.
For convenience and for outcome.
Yes, so that was a major factor that, first, there is a benefit. If you look at the extent of the benefit, actually, it's not that big. You're asking 1,000 patients to switch to another medication, and you're kind of telling them, okay, 992 of you will not benefit, but 8 will benefit, so there's still some benefit, but it's the convenience. So you don't have to monitor your blood. You don't have to go every few days or every few weeks. You don't have to worry about what you eat, what medication you take. Okay, I tried to look at the price of those medications in our context. So the first one would cost, so Syntrom would cost about, so 20 pills, 4 milligrams, about 5,000, so about $5 per month. When we look at the other DOACs, so dabigatran, rivaroxaban, apixaban, it's between $80 and $100 per month. Okay? So let me ask you the question again. Who would recommend in favor of rivaroxaban or the DOACs? Okay. Still have one, two. Who would vote three in favor of the Syntrom? Okay, we have also a few. Yes. Yes, that's true. So you have to factor in the cost. It's not just the medication. It's going, you're getting the labs test done, etc. The point is just to show you that it's not just about the evidence. So first, when we looked at the evidence, we have to quantify what is the evidence, how big is the benefit, and then there is the convenience, but then there's also the cost. So this is the recommendation, and that's my last slide. In patients with DVT of the leg or PE and no cancer, for long-term treatment, the recommendation was in favor of the DOACs over vitamin K antagonists or Syntrom. This was a condition recommendation with B quality of the evidence. So the evidence was not bad. It was good. It could have been a strong recommendation. The reason why it was not a strong recommendation, it was conditional, is because the panel was aware of the issue of the cost. And in some cases, so think about some of your patients, if you tell them it's either $5 or $100, and the benefit is 8 out of 1,000, you have less than 1% chance of benefiting, they will probably go with the cheaper one. So I'll stop.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Any question?
Thank you very much. We've forgotten one important aspect for those of us who treat DVT and PE weekly. There are a lot of factors when you choose between oral anticoagulations and NOACs. A, the profession of the patient. B, the length of treatment. Three, the understanding of the medication. These are all factors that cost does not include the way that they can understand their dietary factors. Besides, there are multiple now new machines that they can test PTINR at home, and where the, if you educate the patient enough, we're educating our patients with MDIs. We can educate for the algorithm how to go up or down with Coumadin. In my opinion, we need to individualize each patient. Risk of bleeding, age, trauma, all of these should be included.
Yes.
And the next comment, I'd like to talk about subsegmental.
Can I just address your first comment?
Please.
I 100% agree with what you said. And in fact, this is what the, so the recommendation was a conditional recommendation. And one of the interpretation of the condition recommendation is that the clinician has to take all these factors into account, has to engage the patients. It's not just one thing. And you know, I tried to illustrate in these couple of slides all these different factors, but definitely there are all these other factors to take into account. Thank you.
On the second topic of subsegmental usually rarely presents with symptoms except pleuritic pain. And in critically sick patients where most of the subsegmental PE are noted, you don't check for subsegmental on someone ambulatory coming to the emergency room with shortness of breath. Obviously, subsegmental PEs are not included there for shortness of breath. But subsegmental PE in sick patients with high-risk DVT are prone to have a fatal disease. Anticoagulation should be a must, or some countries will follow with medical legal aspects. Thank you.
I agree.